Alley-oop, Chapter 1, Oliver Fuckhead.
All right. Next up is Oliver. Oliver, you here? Okay, you're up, man.
So I don't subscribe to the power of now, because I'm always way too busy getting lost in the illusion of tomorrow. The best part about growing up, for me, was always the whole looking forward to it part. Like, I'm 39 years in now, and I still catch myself daydreaming about how awesome things are gonna be when I'm finally grown up. But the fucking other day, I caught a continuity hole. I was watching my older self sailing off the coast of Brazil with a caipirinha in hand, and I noticed that he was younger than I am now in real life, and he still had all his hair. Shit. I've outgrown the future fantasy version of myself. I missed him. He's younger than I thought. Or I'm older than I thought. Either way.
A good-looking couple was sitting in front of the fake stage, which was really just a few apple boxes, in the bar area of a shawarma restaurant. They giggled for a moment. Then one guy in his mid-20s and a wax mustache, the host actually, let out a ha, as aloof as humanly possible while still making an actual sound. And then he cut it off abruptly, making it clear I wouldn't get a quirk more than I deserved. I took a sip of water from my paper Dixie cup, and then the room was a vacuum of silence again. I could feel its suction pulling me apart. A bottle fell off a table below, but it didn't break, and everyone present could hear the oozing and then the frothing of the beer as it foamed up on the stone floor. It was a perfect tag to the pathetic still of the room, the real best joke of the night, and a laugh followed from Mustache in the back until I opened my mouth again. I squinted at the orange floodlight and noticed the dwindling patience of what looked like a teenage comic leaning on the side brick wall, waiting his turn to vent in my place. I'd rather have been watching from one of those warped wooden chairs down there than standing in front with the mic in my hand, because just listening to my drivelling routine of deprecation seemed a step up from having to be the one who, if wasn't dying up there, was getting very sick very fast. But I kept coming back anyway. Maybe to beat something out of me or into me, or maybe just for the free therapy.
I feel like I'm running out of things to look forward to. Like, I let some guy cut me in line for the bathroom the other day just so I'd have a few more minutes of looking forward to peeing. And also because I'm just a spineless person. When I was a kid, haunted with thoughts of Freddy or Jason coming into my apartment to chop everyone up, I'd always imagine how I'd save my own ass by selling my family out. Like, wait, don't kill me. I can help you. My mom's in there, the second bedroom on the right. I'll make you a sandwich. I bet you're starving.
I was jealous of that couple in front, the way they held themselves. They looked like CrossFitters with that perfect posture and those energized expressions. They looked ripe and ready for every passing moment of their lives. I wanted their attention, but I couldn't hold a steady glance with them.
I seem to have trouble looking people in the eye, because when I'm talking to someone, I like to let them know who's boss from the get-go. It's them. It's almost always them. I don't like confrontation, all the way down to exchanging looks with whoever sits opposite me on the subway car. I can always sniff out their animus toward me, and it feels like violence.
Then the mic dropped in and out, but I can't say I was losing them because I never really had them. Choke on that shame, the room seemed to be telling me. I had to get through the next 5 minutes. It was obvious I didn't want to be there, lost in thought. My words were flurries, and after a moment, there'd be no sign I'd ever been there at all.
I don't know why anyone trusts me, really. At a stoplight, when people are walking in front of my car, like in the crosswalk, I get scared my foot's gonna slip, so I put the car in park. And then when a family walks by in front, like pushing a stroller, and they give me that look that, you know not to murder us, right? Look, the pressure is overwhelming. Then I feel like a good person when it's over because I didn't kill them all. I want to yell out the window, am I not merciful?
I heard the crunching of a falafel sandwich by a grizzled, bearded man in his late 60s who probably came for the food but looked like he would stay for the free heat. The compulsion I had to trigger a response from the few people there was as strong as it was in my third grade classroom. I had to get something more, a laugh, a squeak, anything, or I'd be dismissed again. Then the Lower East Side traffic seemed to settle outside. I heard a driver pump the volume of something and the glass windows inside the bar buzzed in vibration from the bass.
So, where was I?
I must have fell asleep on the E-train heading home later that night because the next thing I knew, I was being woken up by the conductor.
Next stop, Kew Gardens.
My MetroCard fell from my lap. The rocking and bumping on the tracks must have cradled me to sleep again. I walked out of the train and up the stairs from the station onto Queens Boulevard. On the corner newsstand rack, I saw that the cover of People magazine hailed Nick Nolte the sexiest man alive. And behind a fridge full of Snapples, Ross Perot was balancing the budget on one of those fat box TV sets for the 92 presidential campaign. I closed my eyes tight and breathed slower. I had tasted insanity before, but never so much that I couldn't pull back at will. When I opened my eyes, teenagers in high-top kicks and high-top fades brushed by me on both sides. One of those contemptuous fuck comics from the bar must have slipped ayahuasca in my water. Or maybe my life was a simulation like I'd always suspected, and the program was finally breaking down. I combed the entire corner around me for an explanation, but the early 90s shitstorm continued. 90210 sideburns and neon and flannel and fucking Color Me Bad's All for Love playing on a bicycle boombox. I checked my phone, but there was no signal. Then I noticed a Russian lady in an 8-ball jacket who was waiting for the cross light, grabbing a hold of a manic little girl who was in the midst of a fit. Then the lady lectured back at her something in Russian. Her kung fu grip on the girl's hand pulled at my attention. And then I couldn't think about anything but that other kid in 1992. That 14-year-old pitiful excuse for a teenager. The weak plant that would never grow into anything worthy of its upkeep. The one who would never be a man. The kid responsible for the disgrace that I was locked inside now. That little son of a bitch. And I knew where to find him.